Welcome to the week in IndyCar, the Marshall Pruitt podcast presented by Cooper Tires. We have our friend Jer Hildebrand getting ready for another crack at the Indianapolis 500. How are you this fine morning in Colorado, and how's a cup of coffee you just brewed?
I'm good, man. I'm an espresso guy, so.
Well, that's...
It's a mini cup of coffee.
Yes, well, we've already started off very Californian here. So, JR, what's the rest of your week going to be like since we're speaking on a Tuesday morning? We've got the GP of Indy kicking off here this weekend, and then practice starts next week. Are you full packing and preparing mode, or is it last couple days uninterrupted with Mrs. Hildebrand? What's your week like?
This year, I mean, kind of no matter how the whether I've been doing, you know, the GP or not over the last bunch of years. Obviously, last year full time is always a busy time of the year, just getting everything started out. So my week this year is I was actually supposed to be in Indianapolis today for an appearance or event. I was supposed to be in with some kids at a school and got canceled, so I actually flew out to Indy and found out that it got canceled once I got there yesterday and just flew back home, which is pretty awesome. So I actually got an extra day. I drive out to Indy every year from Colorado, so...
How long does that take?
You know, we split it up into 2 days. It's a little bit of a, you know, like... I've had to do it in one day before, and it's like a major haul because it's, you know, 1,100 miles or something. So we definitely, I got some practice in for when I do the Cannonball Run, you know, at some point down the road. But my wife is originally from Oklahoma City, or just outside of Oklahoma City. We drive down there, drop the dog off, and then swing back up to Indy. So I'll do that Wednesday, Thursday this week. Be in town in Indy on Friday and be ready to rock and roll beginning next week.
I love it. What do you guys drive? Do you take the old Caddy or?
I always think if I had a little bit more time, you know, I would like sort out a tow vehicle and drag the Coupe de Ville out there, just because that always seems like it'd be awesome, but it never ends up being super practical. Road trips in old cars that the fuel gauge doesn't work properly is—I've done it before, and it's not the most relaxing thing. So we'll jump in the CTSV and load all our stuff in the back and be on our way.
CTSV, you got my heart there already. Well, let's actually talk about a couple of MP podcast items up front, and then we're going to jump into a whole bunch of great IndyCar stuff, and you, as usual, have drawn a ton of excellent questions, so that I'm looking forward to that. So we have our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com that continue to do a pretty cool thing, JR, in sending off either a T-shirt or a mug of my little cartoon character and whatnot to whomever asks my favorite question of the week. So we'll get to that when we kick off questions. But it's been fun seeing folks send back photos of them with my ugly cartoon mug in shirt or whatever form. So it's a trippy thing. I mean, I have to imagine that you as a... you know, longtime IndyCar driver and someone who's been, you know, in the North American spotlight for a while, you're probably not even fazed when you see, you know, a hero card with your face on it or, you know, a banner or whatever. I can just tell you, as a guy who's essentially spent his career behind the scenes, it's a really bizarre thing to see someone wearing a Marshall Pruitt podcast T-shirt.
Man, how awesome! I'm not complaining. It's cool when I see other people doing it, it's like, yeah, right on. Like,
I know. It's not a complaint. It's a bizarre thing, man. It's just
I hear you. Just
bizarre. The other fun thing, which definitely going to announce today, and we'll get into the finer details here shortly, is back around December, our friends at Bell Racing Helmets USA said, hey, want to do something with the podcast when we get to May, when we get to kicking off everything at Indianapolis. And so they're actually going to be my first of a kind of a new thing, and that being a monthly partner. So we obviously have Cooper Tires. They're my podcast's year-long primary sponsor, primary advertiser, and they make this all possible. You know, with their blessing, they said, hey, you know, it's all good if you want to bring in, you know, one or two more. Let's not crowd things. Let's not do the opening of some other podcasts where you hit play and then you listen to 15 minutes and, hey, and we're also, buy this kind of soup. It'll make you feel good. And, hey, do you have toes? Well, you should put socks on them and buy them from this, you know. And you're just falling asleep drooling on whatever. So we're not going to do that to you. We're not going to throw 20 different ads at you. But we will try and do at least one new partner per month. And so Bell Racing Helmets USA has come on board. So we're actually going to do some pretty cool things, JR. I think 19 of the 34 to 35 drivers entered for the 500. I mentioned 34 to 35 because we'll get to Pietro Fittipaldi and Dale Coyne still needing to fill that. But more than half of the folks that will be on the entry list for the 500 are Bell users. So we're going to do some cool things this month. We're actually going to do something very different, and we're actually going to do a daily podcast. It's not going to be the week in IndyCar. I guess it's going to be the day in Indy 500. I'm not sure what we're going to call it, but we're going to do a daily wrap-up at the end of the day. It's not going to be super long. I know I'm going to be bugging you at least to come join us. We're going to try and do all of these in Bell's Garage and Gasoline Alley, but it'll be 10 or 15 minutes, and obviously Robin and I will be writing about this, you know, what's happening each day, doing our end-of-day videos as well. And I figured, well, let's also do something podcast form, because I keep hearing from a lot more people, JR, like, hey, my drive to work is a half hour or 15 minutes or whatever. And,
yeah,
you know,
it's so easy.
These podcasts are just, you know, something that I keep hearing folks say, hey, it helps pass the time. So I figure even though we're going to be hitting you with words on racer.com and videos on racer.com, we'll also try and serve up, you know, like I said, 10, 15 minute end of day wrap up. Going to try and bring up whether it's different drivers, engineers, whomever. I don't know. But just trying to bring a little bit of flavor from the track. So that's going to be something new. We're also going to do a round table at Bell's shop there in Speedway, and still planning on that, but I know they're hoping to have four or five drivers there and do some pretty cool giveaways to, you know, access to come in and watch that live. So anyways, man, just it's kind of fun to see, for me at least, this little thing that I do with my podcast. It's the one and only thing that's mine. Everything else I do work related is for a client. So just kind of fun to see it getting a little bit of legs and having someone like Bell Racing US, Bell Helmets USA, wanting to come in and say, hey, let's have some month of May fun. So with all that stuff aside, tell us a little bit about Dry and Reinbold Racing. Not only your return to that team, JR, for the month of May here, but you guys are going to be in an interesting situation, right? It's not as if you will have done a couple of races with this new Universal Aero kit, either road course, short oval, you know, super speedway trim. You guys are going to be turning up and really having to mash the throttle on the education side to learn what it wants and needs. Tell us a little bit about the engineering team you and your teammate Sage are going to have. And are there any shortcuts that a partner like Chevrolet or otherwise can maybe help you, you know, do some advanced learning so you're not, you know, burning the first 4 or 5 days just trying to figure out what you have?
Yeah. Well, the engineering team at Dryer. Well, first, like, I'm super excited to be running with these guys. You know, I know from driving around Sage over the last bunch of years in practice, but especially in the races, which is, you know, where everybody really does have it just like all on the table. Everybody's on the same, you know, fuel strategies and, you know, tires and all that kind of stuff. That that car has been bad fast, and you know he's been able to do a lot with it. So, you know, was excited to be able to put together, and the engineering squad that we've got for this year is, you know, the team's like always been really good at sort of the engineering by committee. Jeff Britton is the primary, you know, he's like full time guy on the 24 car. He sort of acts as like technical director for the team. Got a couple of great assistants. The primary on my car is going to be Chase Kaufman, who was Jeremy Millis's assistant engineer at, I actually worked with him back at Panther.
Oh, wow.
He started out working at Panther, I think, as a, on an internship from IUPUI.
Wow.
And, so he and I were both, you know, sort of rookies in the mix. You know, he was doing data and moved up the ranks a little bit there, went over to Sarah Fisher, you know, went with Jeremy to ECR when that all kind of merged. I was looking forward to, you know, when I knew Jeremy was going to take off last year, you know, all of this happened kind of like before my deal came together, but Jeremy took off. I was sort of angling for Chase to be my primary at the time, heading into my full-time season last year at ECR. He ended up getting like a killer job offer to go work for Cruise, which is General Motors' autonomous vehicle development arm. So he's been doing that, living in Arizona, but helped the team last year, and he's going to be coming back out to work full-time on my car. So I'm really excited about it. He and I, you know, been in touch a lot over the last, you know, couple of years, and certainly, you know, in recent months, about all kinds of stuff. So looking forward to working with him. And Andy O'Gara is going to be my strategist on the stand. Got a bunch of guys that I've worked with before. Brad Larson's my chief mechanic, who was my chief mechanic last year at ECR. So, got, you know, like really good, really solid group of guys. I think in going through the engineering and kind of the setups and, you know, what we've been doing, there's some things that are different and things that I'm looking forward to, you know, getting in and trying. Obviously, Sage being there, you know, him and Jeff together will be a good benchmark just for, as we look at the aero kit, just for trying to figure out, okay, you know, apples to apples compared to last year, you know, what do they feel like are the differences? You know, it's hard for me to, getting into a car with a different setup and the new kit, it'll be a little bit more difficult to figure out just with their setup compared to their setup in the past, what's different. So that'll be, you know, super helpful to have a set of teammates that have been there and done it before. And to your question about, you know, what are the other things that we can do to get up to speed? You know, we've all been, I personally have been putting in some time, but, you know, as a group, we've been, you know, getting on the horn to kind of pester the Pratt & Miller and Chevy guys as much as we can, just to try to figure out, you know, kind of what are the general trends. Pratt & Miller, you know, obviously having been full-time last year and working with ECR over the last handful of years, I know how good those guys are. Obviously, the Elmore guys as well, but the Pratt & Miller guys on the vehicle dynamics side, you know, it gets in pretty deep into understanding the aero package, understanding the vehicle dynamics, using their tools. You know, I mean, I think you'd see that, you know, even the Penske boys are, you know, leaning on that stuff, you know, pretty heavily at times. So, you know, there's a lot of information there. A lot of it still for everybody is kind of speculative. You know, everybody got like a day or a day and some change under their belt last week. So that gives everybody just kind of a general feel for what the car is like. Seems like it sort of matches, you know, the expectations based on all the data and information that we have currently. And, you know, so our job really is to kind of pull everything together, be prepared when we first go out on track to make sure we're not wasting time just, you know, kind of getting things in order and, you know, getting with the program. But I feel, you know, for me, I feel there, it's definitely, you know, it's a little daunting that things are new and we've got one less day of practice. So, you know, if you get a rain day or something like that, it takes away a lot more time kind of on a percentage basis of running the car. But, I know the team's been really well equipped in the past and, you know, I think we got a good group of guys. So for me, we should be ready to go.
Having been there, it was interesting to see both the effects of wind. It was very, very windy on Wednesday during the manufacturer test day. We saw that Tony Kanaan put up a 226 and change. That was with the high boost. And he did that in the morning. It was interesting to see I mean, you know this, JR. Our listeners will know it now, but when we go from, call it the average boost used in practice and on race day, but when we make that jump to high boost for a qualifying weekend and Fast Friday to prepare for it, it's worth on average about 4.5 miles an hour. You know, you could say five, but, you know, round numbers five, but roughly 4.5 miles per hour. It was very interesting on Wednesday to see that Tony, at the end of lunch, the going into the lunch break, was at that 226 and change, which, if you looked at the second fastest driver, it was round about, you know, 4.5 to 5 miles an hour faster. So it stood out pretty clearly that, you know, the manufacturers were trying to do some high boost runs, to do some simulations for qualifying and whatnot, but also you had a lot of folks primarily focusing on race day running per se. And then you move back to Monday, where we had 21 drivers in action there. And then we had the rookies and refreshers the day after, and you know, we had wind, we had perfect conditions, we had everything. We had some drafting going on. It's just interesting to see that this 2018 Speedway Aero kit, which definitely has more drag than the previous model, is still capable of putting up some fairly good speeds. And it will certainly be interesting to see what happens come qualifying, to see if we can get close to that 232 Scott Dixon did last year. I think, you know, most people are saying they think 230-ish, maybe a 231 might be possible in optimal conditions. But just nice to see that a totally different approach to aerodynamics at the super speedways is not something that has drastically altered the car's ability to go fast. So I know that's something you appreciate as well. Different mindset, yet more or less same result.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, when you dig into the nuances of it, it's definitely different. You know, like you mentioned, I think a lot of people initially thought, you know, with the rear pods and all that kind of stuff, removing all of that stuff, that it would, you know, reduce drag. In fact, it's, you know, increased the drag. Those things actually did a lot to both add downforce and take away drag to clean up the flow over the back of the car. So the cars have more drag this year. You know, the tuning window of the aerodynamics is much smaller, so we've got the difference between kind of max trim and, you know, minimum trim, basically like the least amount of drag that you can run, is a much larger, less efficient swing in downforce for, you know, a less total amount of drag from kind of one end of the spectrum to the other. So, you know, I think you'll see, because the cars have, you know, they're probably kind of maybe similar kind of speeds in race trim. We've basically, for the maximum trim level that we run at the Speedway this year, it's a couple hundred pounds less downforce than the last few years, which initially on paper, a lot of us thought, man, like, you know, we were running that much downforce for a reason, you know, taking away 200 pounds, that's kind of a big step. But then you think back to, you know, the car doesn't have the dome skid on anymore. You know, we're lowering it back down. The car gets more efficient. Center of gravity is lower. Works better. You look back to the numbers that we were at in race trim prior to the dome skid, and we're kind of back in that same range. So basically, when they added the dome skid, we had to run an extra couple hundred pounds worth of downforce just to make the car kind of work properly, because it was all, you know, a little bit higher up in the air, and CG was higher and less efficient. So I think the expectation is that in race trim, from a downforce perspective, it'll basically feel in the same window as it's been for several years now. Maybe back to a little bit more of the, you know, pre-aero kit DW12 style of race. But the cars, even at that downforce level, you know, have more drag. So I think that's where you see, you know, you wouldn't normally on a practice day, like the open test day, see that big of a difference between kind of like the average on your own lap time and or lap speed and the toe speeds that quickly. You know, I mean, there was like a big, big jump.
Oh, yeah.
You know, guys running 226 from a, you know, maybe 219 or, you know, to something like that. So, you know, potentially 6-7 miles per hour, you know, that's enough. I think that's due to the fact that the cars are punching a bigger hole in the air and the effect of the draft is more significant. So I think that's, you know, one of the things that we'll be paying attention to as we do our race running. And, you know, you mentioned in sort of qualifying trim, I guess at this point I'm thinking it'll be a little bit of a surprise if we see guys going 230, just because it's really hard to shed that much drag off the car, you know? So it'll be interesting once we start getting a little closer, get to Fast Friday, start being able to map out what the conditions over that weekend are going to be. You know, it doesn't make it any less difficult to stick it in the top nine, but, you know, I think the general thought, at least from what I've seen, is to expect the cars being a little bit slower than they've been, for sure.
Let's talk a little bit about rather unfortunate circumstance, JR. You might have seen the footage of young Pietro Fittipaldi having his first, you know, big bone-breaking, you know, injury onboarding type event. I mean, you hope as a driver, obviously, that you get to be, you know, get to the end of your career and never have an injury that sidelines you. I don't know if it's better for this to happen while Pietro is still young and 19, or in the middle of his career when he's in his prime. I'm not sure if there's an optimal timing for things. I can tell you that the Dale Coyne Racing team is really, really disappointed with what happened, because they were looking forward to him really being a big contributor to the team. Not saying that their other drivers would not be big contributors as well, but A, they really love the kid. Just he's a charming, charming little fella. But he's also someone that, despite having limited IndyCar oval experience, does bring actually a fairly solid resume with him from some NASCAR things that he's done. So they were counting on him to be a big part of their success this month. And now they're having to search for a replacement. Let's just talk before we get into some of the search angle.
Yeah.
What's it been like for you, JR, having to deal with injuries at, you know, inopportune times in your career? I mean, heck, I remember that that media thing at Texas where you damn near blew out your knee and then had to race the rest of the year. I mean, how does stuff like this affect, you know, you as a young driver trying to make your name and knowing that, man, I got to spend some time with a cast on or whatever it is, and I hope I don't lose momentum career-wise once I once I'm ready to go.
Well, I think, you know, in Pietro's case, I haven't been around him personally, but, you know, I can sort of like validate what you say about the team. I remember talking to Jimmy Vassar for a little bit at Long Beach, and he was just talking about how, you know, impressed he was that he was kind of as collected as he was, didn't have, you know, a big entourage around, you know, as a Fittipaldi, you know, maybe guys weren't totally sure how he would kind of come into the fray, but, you know, very serious about his craft and all that kind of stuff. I think, you know, as far as the injury goes, I guess my view of it would be that it's much easier to have those things happen while you're on the come up, you know. There's not a lot of expectations for exactly how you're going to be performing at that point. You know, he's built up, I think, a level of, you know, sort of credibility and interest that's not going to go away because he's, you know, had an unfortunate accident. And certainly just from a physical perspective, you know, much easier to have these types of things happen when you're young, but when you're in your, you know, 30s going into your 40s or something, you know. So I think I wouldn't expect from the outside that this has a significant impact on his career trajectory or his opportunities. You know, and certainly, you know, Sebastian went through this in a much more significant fashion than I did, you know, than I have over the years. I've sort of been fortunate to be able to more or less drive through whatever injuries I've had. But, yeah, I mean, you mentioned I raced, you know, a season, you know, a little bit more than half a season with a torn ACL in 2011, and then, you know, had broken hand last year. So it's just, you know, there are things that you have to kind of deal with and surround yourself with good, you know, physical therapy and doctors and that kind of stuff. I mean, the great thing about being a part of the racing community, certainly I've experienced this as part of the IndyCar community, is, you know, you just have access to, like, really awesome people to work on these things, and everybody knows there's no like room for interpretation in terms of what your goals are. You know, it's get back in the car as quickly as possible and be healthy and, you know, crank on your rehab and all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I'd expect him to be back sooner than later, and, you know, bummer for everybody involved that it's, the, you know, the timing of it is that he'll end up kind of missing his first chance at the 500, but, you know, I'm sure he'll be back sooner than later.
So a couple other quick angles on this to hit JR before we move on to one more topic and then Q&A. So I happened to text with Pietro a couple days ago, and he said, look, I'm going to do everything I can to get back ASAP. And that's the exact mindset you want to hear, because you can go one of two ways. If you are, you know, still young and you get hurt, like seriously hurt, you know, you're gonna take it one of two ways. You're either going to question whether this is the smartest thing to do with one's life, or B, you're going to use it as crazy motivation to, you know, just go psycho in rehab and everything else to get back immediately and not let it become a thing. It's awesome to hear that, you know, this kid who's pretty mellow, you know, fairly, you know, softly spoken, just good to hear that the fire is burning even brighter with him. Spent some time on the topic of who might replace him. It's a lot of moving parts there. I spent some time Sunday morning at Mid-Ohio speaking with Sebastian Saavedra, who in an article I mentioned he would appear to be in pole position, if they want to be, for to jump into that ride, because Dale Coyne, from, you know, some things that I've heard from folks who tend to be knowledgeable, have said this truly is not an easy thing in terms of, well, who do we need to drop in? It's who can we find that is skilled but also brings a budget. And the budget part, from everything I've heard, and I've heard it multiple times now, that's non-negotiable. So, you know, ringing up Fernando Alonso and saying, hey, Fred, got a free seat, or Lewis Hamilton, or, you know, there's a lot of folks, and it's been good fun as well, JR, watching, you know, looking at folks on social media saying, well, how about this guy, and how about, you know, he or yeah. she, and you go, these
not
are...
Not ever quite that simple.
Yeah, these are all great ideas, don't get me wrong, but there's the part two. Do they have a budget? So I know that, you know, AFS Racing, Gary Peterson, and Sebastian Saavedra, I think I can say this without betraying any confidences, their conversation's taken place. I think anyone who knows them and knows the game knew the conversations would be taking place. But here's the interesting part, JR, and this could be wrong, but again, these are things that I've heard that aren't quite solid enough for me to write about yet, but I do believe this could be shaping the conversation. So with this number 19, Dale Coyne Racing Honda, it's being shared between Zachary Clayman DeMello and Pietro Fittipaldi. Pietro was scheduled to be in the car for the GP of Indy, the 500, and then come back for Texas, and there were going to be some other primarily oval races on his end. Well, with Pietro out for these two rounds in May at least, and then some more coming up after that, I've heard that since he's not going to be in the car, and you know, you have two ways that things tend to get paid for, right, Jer, when it comes to a driver like Pietro who is bringing some sponsors with him,
right.
You know, they either, the payment method could happen a couple ways, you know, could be lump sum all up front, that's a bit of a rarity. The more common approach is some sort of regularly scheduled payments. And
you're forgetting the promise of a lump sum down the road somewhere.
Oh yeah, that is true. I'm forgetting. Oh man, boy, when
still happens, man.
When we get to the final race, boy, are you gonna have a sweetheart of a check waiting for you? Hey, we can't find that guy. Where'd he go? From some things that I've heard, They haven't been, you know, verified by multiple sources yet, but it sounds somewhat accurate. Knowing that Pietro was meant to be in the car, you know, multiple months, multiple races throughout the year, I've heard that the payment schedule plan is what was in place, and that since it looks like he's not going to be in the car for the next, you know, for this month, next month possibly, a couple things open up here, right? A,
yeah.
Well, you know, you're going to be missing out on a, you know, I think he was doing six, seven races, something like that. Well, if you're going to be missing out on almost half your season, will there be a genuine reason to return for just a couple, since this plan's kind of been derailed by injury? And second, well, if that's the case and we're not going to be driving, then the question of the payments coming in for events that we're not doing, well, that's obviously not going to go forward. So it creates an interesting scenario where we're not just talking about trying to find someone to drive the car for the GP or the 500 or Texas or some of the other ovals.
Yeah.
It's, huh, so could Coyne be talking to drivers and saying, yeah, we're not just talking about month of May now. I'd like to, you know, what I would really rather do is sign you up for all the ovals that Pietro's
the
going to miss.
Events, yeah.
And that then changes the dynamic, doesn't it? Because it's one thing if I said, hey, Marshall Pruitt, he's going to hop in that car for the 500, and I go talk to a sponsor and they say, great, we're in for whatever that dollar amount is for the 500. Then you hear, okay, well, that's fine, but we also want money for Texas and, you know, and. That complicates things, right? Because as I have ambulances and fire trucks going on behind me here, that changes the dynamic, because just getting a sponsor for the Speedway, JR, that might actually be the easiest part, but that wouldn't necessarily fulfill the entire obligation if that's what the team is going after.
Yeah, I mean, I think ideally, you know, the problem is just the timing of it all, right? Like, you got to fill the first, you know, hole here in a hurry, and that might not leave you with enough time to work out the best option. Your best option in the short term may not be your best long-term option, and, you know, at some point here within the week, you get to a point that you don't have a choice. So I think that's definitely the tricky part of this, for sure. You know, I wouldn't be shocked if Pietro, depending on what his sort of, what the diagnosis is in terms of how long he's going to be out, you know, he's doing a partial season to start with. Wouldn't be shocked if he's trying to get back into the car, get back to into an Indy car before the end of the year, if he, you know, has the option to do that based on his injuries and recovery and all that kind of stuff. But one way or the other, whether it's just a couple of events here in May or it's these two and then Texas and maybe one other, or, you know, whatever it is, it's a tricky spot for Dale to be in, and additionally tricky because you want to keep that car running full time. You know, a big part of these conversations these days is about, you know, being able to maintain kind of leader circle
yep.
commitment, and, you know, to some, I mean, I've been in this, I was in this conversation with the ECR guys, you know, a couple of years ago. We were trying to get full time, and, you know, it was maybe going to be partial seasons getting put together and all this kind of stuff, and, you know, the just as a group, we weren't all paying enough attention to the math for, you know, how much you actually needed once you were, you know, basically once you get to leader circle, it almost offsets the cost of like three or four events potentially.
Yeah.
Because, you know, that's sort of underwriting a part of your full season commitment. So, you know, there's a lot of things in play. Yeah, I definitely don't envy team owners in these positions, because they're just, it's a tricky sort of road to navigate. But, you know, I'm imagining, particularly with there being, you know, a bump day qualified entry list, you know, you got to get somebody in the car that you trust can sort of make it happen here. Obviously, there's kind of an immediate financial hole to fill, to your point. Usually easier to make that happen for Indianapolis than it is for, you know,
Iowa.
You know, let's say
whatever.
You need a few, you know, a couple of whatever, three or what, I'm making this up, but let's say it's $200,000 or $300,000 or something to kind of like fill the gap at Indy. You know, that's easier to do than even if it's just $200,000 or $250,000 for, you know, Texas, right? So, you know, tricky spot to be in, and I think we'll kind of get a feel for what the long-term outlook is looking like based on how they make decisions here in the short term.
It is pretty insane to think about how a 5-second accident in Belgium can turn things completely, you know, on a team's head and add so many angles to consider. And there's one other thing to throw in here, too, and I've heard this mentioned as a fallback. You cracked open the topic of leader circle, that being two full-time Dale Coyne entries, the number 18 driven by Sebastian Bourdais, the number 19, as we mentioned, shared by Fittipaldi and Clayman DeMello. Well, those two are, you know, they signed a contract that said, we will be at every race with these two cars, with these two entry numbers, and in exchange, IndyCar gives them, you know, a little over $1 million per entry. And so I've heard that if they fail to come to terms with a suitably skilled and funded driver for that fourth car, they could indeed go forward with three. And what would likely then happen is either Connor Daly, who is one of their month of May drivers, or Pippa Mann as well, one of them numerically would be shifted over to the 19 car, so that while they would be down one entry, the number 19 would satisfy its leader circle obligations. So we would essentially have a number change, and I think, you know, more or less that's it. At the same time, again, worst case scenario here, where if they were to drop down to three, you would then also have a fourth car worth of mechanics and engineers and otherwise that I don't know if they would be truly out of work or if they would be reapportioned to, you know, help with the other three entries, just add some, you know, extra skill and talent there. So anyways, man, just amazing how this one thing at a sports car race in Belgium over the weekend has just set so many dominoes in motion.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So what do we take away from this? Don't race in Belgium before the Indy 500, boys and girls. That's the definite
no,
lesson.
Definitely race in Belgium before the Indy 500. That's awesome.
Yay! Well, let's move
into...
Don't
get hurt racing in Belgium before the Indy 500.
Oh, you know, that's going to be the new requirement, folks. Let's delve into one other topic before we get to Q&A. And I spoke about this a couple times last week on some end-of-day videos, and I have a feeling we're going to talk about it a lot more throughout the month of May, JR. And that is, having moved from the 2017 manufacturer aero kits produced by Chevy and Honda that had seemingly a million little bits and pieces and bobs and things you could add and remove to give you different aerodynamic results, whether it was downforce, drag, moving center of pressure, fore and aft. There's so many little things that you could do. Also big things, right? The Chevy's a particular side pod configuration. Even, you know, we'd seen splitting with one side pod configuration on the left, different than the right. On the rear wheel pods sometimes would have the little upper wing element there on one side, not the... I mean, there's a lot, again, tunability like you wouldn't believe. And now we move into this universal aero kit where you don't really have a lot of that anymore. You don't have the ability to put on bolt wickers onto every surface imaginable. You have a far fewer choices, aero-wise, to really get the car to a place that, you know, maybe you could through 10 or 20 other means last year. Tell me a little bit about that mindset-wise, GR, knowing that you have fewer things to really dial in perfection, maybe, than you did before. And second, tell us a little bit about what we're going to hear spoken of very frequently because of this, and that is now having to optimize mechanical setup maybe more than ever, because aero tuning isn't going to get you as far as maybe it once could.
I mean everything you said is exactly right. You know, particularly being in the Chevy camp, you know, every year at Indy, you know, with the aero kits, you know, I mean, you can drive yourself nuts trying to figure out exactly what you're running, and then you're watching everybody else go out, and, you know, everybody's always on something totally different. Like, different teams have different philosophies in terms of what's working and what's not based on their own wind tunnel data, and, you know, the differences in efficiency and downforce and drag between all of these little bits and pieces was, you know, really small, you know, and had a number of overlapping you know, sort of configurations in terms of where they were at in the, like, L over D scale, and...
That would be lift over drag?
Yeah, and, like, sometimes, you know, I think basically at ECR, we sort of migrated towards one philosophy of what of those kind of overlapping configurations was better, that was different than the Penske guys. You know, it was kind of like the whole thing was, a lot of your month, frankly, you know, as you built up to qualifying, was just kind of making sure that we had our head on straight and we were actually experiencing the effect on track that the numbers were suggesting that we were going to get to, and all this kind of stuff. Fortunately for us, you know, particularly last year, we were, I think, really, really good at that. But, you know, this year it's really back to kind of pre-aero kit DW12 style of downforce trim. So basically the way that the scale works is that you'll take wing out until you can't take any more wing out, and then you'll transition if the car still has enough grip, to going to trimmed diffuser sidewalls, and then to removed diffuser sidewalls, and that those two steps are super inefficient at the very end of the scale. So that's kind of like if the conditions are good and everything's solid and you're feeling good for four laps, you know, then you can squeeze a little bit of added performance for like a potentially a significant amount of grip loss by going to those diffuser you know, sort of options. And that even at that, you know, back in 2014, like pre-aero kit, you know, you could run asymmetrically trimmed sidewalls. You could do the trimming kind of like yourself, I think. So you had some different options in terms of how the sidewall, like, you know, edges of the diffuser were worked out. This year, it's very simple. Either you run them both trimmed and everybody, you know, runs the same amount, or you have to remove both of them. To your point, what that all kinds of end up leading to is basically the downforce trim levels are much more simple and straightforward. There's not all of this other crazy stuff. You're not going to see guys, you know, adding and removing body panels or parts or, you know, whatever. And it'll, I think being fast in qualifying will be kind of even more reliant than in years past on, you know, just straight up mechanical drag. So, you know, gearbox and uprights and, you know, all that kind of stuff, that just allows the car to basically roll down the straightaway more freely. And your mechanical setup of the car, how much grip can you build into it to try to chase those last maybe handful of trim steps? And, you know, can you keep the car from losing speed via scrub and tire degradation over four laps? Those things have definitely been a part of qualifying over the last few years, but I would say just tuning to the right aero level has been more significant in the last couple of years than sort of tuning to and optimizing the right aero level, whereas, you know, this year it'll be coming down to more of some of those kind of more traditional factors, I think.
One of the reasons, dear listeners of the Week in IndyCar and the Marshall Pruitt podcast presented by Cooper Tires, that I try and have folks like Jared Hildebrand on. Last week we had Charlie Kimball on. I definitely enjoy when we have guests on and try and have folks like yourself, JR, who can tell us great things about being a race car driver and answer those questions, but also make us smarter. And that's not taking a jab at anyone else doing any other podcasts or radio or whatever, but it's one thing to talk about stuff. It's another thing for me to go away going, cool, I know more, I'm smarter, or in my case, less dumber. So good call. And also, I really didn't think of it, but I guess had my pea brain fired up, I would have realized that, now I get why so many people have sent in questions today referring back to 2011 and you and Charlie Kimball, because I've had Kimball and Hildebrand on back-to-back. Yeah, so fun there. Well, hey, let's get into some Q&A, my man. And as I mentioned at the outset, we start off every week where I pick my favorite question from the previous week, so our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com can send the person either a T-shirt or a mug. And since I know that one of my favorite questions this week is going to be a technical one, I'm going to pick one from last week that wasn't technical, and that's going to go to Tom Cottle. And his question of, hey, fellas, I would like to know if Robin could tell a couple of funny Bobby Unser stories, impression expected, too. And Robin certainly didn't disappoint and did his spot-on Uncle Bobby impression. So, Tom, that certainly my favorite question from last week. So send me a little DM here on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast Facebook page. Give me your address, your email address, and tell me whether you want a shirt or a mug. And if it's a shirt, what size? And our friends at TorontoMotorsports.com will get you hooked up. I would also suggest, and this is just a suggestion, there's no money, by the way, exchanged here between me and Toronto Motorsports. They're just good friends and good people. They're the ones who do those awesome cartoons each for each IndyCar race, JR. And
anyways, sweet.
They're good folks. So, look, if they're going to give my listeners some free swag, the least I can do is suggest folks check out their website and at least get stickered up, man. All right there. And I'm hoping someone asks about your choice of car number for the month of May in our Q&A here, and if not, I will be sure to do so. But let's go with the first question actually filed, and that was from Gabe Argenta. He said, I'd like both of your thoughts on this. Who do we have to bribe to get the Indy GP to run the banking in the final turn, oval turn one, like Formula One did, and even the Grand Am Series used to? Or why shouldn't they do it? So I think we know who to bribe, JR. I just don't know if you and I have enough money to actually pull that. Well, you know, I could hold Doug Bowles upside down and, you know, do something like that. But
run the banking, Doug.
Do you like that idea?
I do. I mean, I think the... Yeah, last little section is always a little kind of tricky. The tough thing with the track, I mean, let's just be totally honest. The tough thing about it is that because it's built on the inside of the speedway, there's just no elevation change. I think they've done a really good job kind of tweaking it over the years, and like that kind of that infield section's definitely gotten more interesting. It's a little bit faster. The cars have to twitch and move a little bit more to get through. What is it? Kind of like 7, 8, 9 or whatever that is in the middle of the infield by the mounds. You know, I think anything we can do to make it a little bit more intriguing. It's obviously got a long front straight as it is. You know, the cars over the last couple of years, following guys close coming onto the front straight, you know, the way that we open up onto the front straight now can be pretty tough. So the one thing that I think would be interesting about using the banking outside of the fact that you would just be totally hauling the mail going down to turn one, which is always sort of cool if you have the opportunity to do it, is that, you know, you create a really long section to be able to draft up and get by somebody, which I think is always, you know, given that, you know, we're kind of splitting hairs on whether one corner or another really makes the track, you know, more interesting or whatever, that could be an interesting kind of win just as far as the event itself goes. So, I'd be game for certainly getting some cars out there and giving it a shot one of these days. Maybe next time they have a test day, they can test out some of the other configurations, because they've got, you know, the whole MotoGP section that, you know, we run it backwards to how counter-course to how the MotoGP guys run it, but their last handful of turns before they dump back out onto the, you know, chicane onto the front straightaway, which is our, you know, sort of after turns 3 and 4, you know, they would stay tight to the right there. There's a couple extra corners, whereas we go through that high-speed chicane onto the back straight. You know, there's some different places that they could change its configuration, add and subtract distance and stuff like that. I'd be game for a little bit of a mix-up here for the GP course.
I think the other question we should ask, which team and driver could we bribe going into, say, opening practice on Friday? Or how's this? One of the practice sessions to throw in some extra tall gears, at least, you know, on the top end, and just intentionally blow the final corner complex to you to go counter course in turn one and see what kind of top speed.
I think the best guy to talk to about it is Mario in the two-seater, to be honest with you.
Ooh, yes. Yeah, that's
Mario
great...
would make it happen.
Yeah.
No sweat.
And
nice bottle of wine.
Oh, Mario doesn't need a dang thing. And the thing is he would want Marco's car. He wouldn't want the two-seater. He'd want to go do it, you know. And if
give me a fresh set of reds.
I mean, you know, Marco's been wearing that tribute helmet, so, we, you know, if he played it right, just rolled out while strapped into the car, folks might not even know, other than potentially his speed at the end of the session. So and I won't make any comments as to whether I think Mario would be faster or slower. So, tacked on to a Gabe's question, Vinny Taibbi said, hey, what's your take on the Indy GP for a season finale? And I would say, Vinny, because we've heard this thrown around, you know, we're not sure if Sonoma is going to continue to be the finale after this season. Heard this thrown around. I'll tell you this, JR. I would say no chance, no way, if it were a day race. Because optics matter, and that, you know, Indy looks absolutely empty with 100,000 people in it.
You're right.
So if it was a night race, which would effectively mask the lack of hundreds of thousands of people there, then I would love the idea. But if it was a day race, it's the exact opposite of what IndyCar needs right now, which would be to look weak and unimportant at its, you know, effectively the track that made it what it is. So though that would be my only concern.
You know, I think you're right, and I think that, you know, for Sonoma, for as much as it ends up being a little bit of a parade in terms of the way the race itself actually plays out, it has, you know, the way that the race has gone, because the track itself is just so difficult to get right on a day-to-day basis, even over the race weekend. You know, I mean, I've been there a bunch of times, and I think it's the track that any team outside of Penske seems to have it dialed in. Like, you're always kind of, you know, at times, like, throwing darts in the dark, trying to figure out, like, what is this place requiring of the car and driver to, like, work properly today, right now, with the wind direction this way, and, like, the, you know, ambient temp like this. You know, we've had Scott Dixon and Montoya finishing the season tied a couple of years ago. It's made for some drama, despite the fact that the actual race itself is not always highly dramatic. And to your point, it is really important for the series to be able to end on a note where everybody that's involved in the series, the sponsors, the team sponsors, the teams themselves, you know, can kind of, like, end the thing on a little bit of a high note where everybody's looking forward to getting back at it the next season. And so I think from that perspective, it's not to say that sponsorship value is the only thing that matters, but having a good event definitely matters at the end of the season. And I think running at Indy is interesting from that perspective because it is obviously the home of what made the sport what it is, you know, in the speedway. I guess it, to your point, it remains to be seen whether the road course as a standalone event can really be that, you know, hallmark type of deal. You know, it sort of never really was for F1. It, you know, came and went for MotoGP. It's hard to sort of fathom that that's the solution, you know, but I agree with you. I mean, I think however it worked out, even if it was just running in the middle of the season, it would be interesting just to know whether the draw is different when it's touted as its own standalone event. And maybe if it is, you know, I've always loved the idea of doing a night race. I think doing a night race on the speedway would be really rad. But, you know, you'd have to play with some of those factors, I think, even to have an idea of whether that's a reasonable solution or not.
Got some good questions, JR, on Twitter. We usually get most of our questions in on the old MP podcast Facebook page, but I want to jump over to Twitter here, and might, if you have the willingness or the ability, you might go into overtime a little bit, just because we've got we've had a bunch of really good questions come in.
Try to keep my answers tight.
Yes. Don Davis, he says, I have to wonder, with all the wingdings and doodads gone with the Universal Aero Kit 2018, is there less of a need for the aero screen now? Please don't get me wrong, I'm 100% in favor of this device. That's an interesting point. I don't know if I'd heard that one raised, because we don't have as many things to get knocked off and potentially impact a driver's helmet, but it doesn't mean there aren't things that, you know, Doesn't mean there are no things that could get knocked off. What do you think?
Well, I guess I would, you know, my personal view of the movement towards the aero screen, you know, head protection, whatever, is that, you know, we are in the process. In my opinion, we should view ourselves as being in the process of working our way towards something that, like, can deflect a left front upright assembly. You know,
heavy piece. That is.
Yeah, like, which the aero screen in its current configuration, we don't know. Maybe it would effectively do that in certain situations, and that would be like a huge win. We're sort of talking about it that the expectation is more, you know, glancing stuff off of it, you know, parts of the front wing or, you know, things like that, bodywork, as opposed to like a big heavy piece of metal. And so with that being said, I just think that in the big scheme of things, we should be looking at this as something that is a continuous development towards something that is like actually meaningful to reduce the risk of errant debris at a level that could kill a driver. And that I would say in open wheel racing right now, regardless of what the traditional view of what an open wheel car looks like or should be or whatever, that is basically from talking to guys that are not open wheel drivers, I know this to be fact, like guys that you would love to see driving an open wheel car. The fact that the cars go as fast as they do, the fact that you might have an incident like Sebastian last year at Indy is actually, those aren't the things that keep guys from racing in the Indy 500 or driving an Indy car. The thing that keeps guys from taking that more seriously or, you know, and the things that frankly I think as Indy car drivers, you know, that we think about in terms of where we should be trying to go is the fact that there is still just this, like, you could it completely out of your own control possibility that, you know, something happens, like what happened to J-Dub.
Yeah.
And, you know, we are all, obviously, we're all doing this, having assessed and accepted the risk that this is just dangerous and the cars are going super fast and you're going to have things happen that you can't react to and, you know, all that kind of stuff. There's an inherent level of trust that, you know, we place in the other drivers that we're racing against and the teams and the crews and, you know, all that kind of stuff. But, you know, this is something that is just kind of out of anybody's control and can happen at a moment's notice. So from my perspective, the fact that the cars at some point have more or less stuff that could fly off of them, that's better than not, I think, just for the sake of having less debris on a, you know, global scale. Like, it causes less cautions because you have less debris, but that should have no impact on our, you know, sort of progression towards at least exploring mechanisms to you know, add that little bit of extra, you know, reduce that kind of peak risk, basically, of what we're doing. And it's my view entirely that if we can reduce that peak risk, then, you know, you could actually sort of increase the average risk of how fast the cars go and the way they race and doing all that kind of stuff. Right now, we're sort of boxed into a corner that none of those things can change, you know, until we address sort of the elephant in the room.
The good old elephant. Let's move up to a question from John Sable, who we can always count on for asking pretty sharp things. And this isn't specific to you, but it's an interesting topic. It says, it's early, but Pato O'Ward looks like the clear favorite in Indy Lights this year. If he goes on to win the title, gets that $1 million check from Mazda to advance, it says, is there space for him full-time at Andretti Autosport? What happens to Colton Herta? Does he move up? Does Steinbrenner become a satellite Andretti team? Interesting, right? Because if you think of Andretti Autosport, team you know very well, JR, having done great things there in your Mazda Road to Indy career, they are four cars full-time. They're six for the month of May. We know that with young George Steinbrenner, the 15th or whatever exactly he is numerically, he's expressed an interest saying, hey, after a couple years in lights with Colton, you know, we want to move up to IndyCar with him. So in that scenario, we could be at 5 next year. Whether that's 5 under the same tent, or as John mentioned, trying to do a little bit of a satellite, you know, with a separate operation, I'm not totally sure. But then you think about Pato, who's driving for Andretti, could certainly be, you know, the champion this year. And you know, as someone who's been a part of the Andretti ladder, the goal would obviously be to move up with them if possible. But you know what it's like, having done great thing in lights. And then, well, my debuts with Dryden Reinbold and then Panther. And so maybe you're the, you know, maybe you're the perfect guy to talk about, you know, if you can't continue up the ladder to the big show with the team you're with on the ladder system, is that something to be concerned about, or not so much?
I think it's certainly something you aim to do, you know, and so, you know, but you obviously only have so much power over how that works. I mean, when I, you know, for me, when I, the it was a, you know, full house when I was, when I graduated out of Indy Lights, I did some testing for Andretti Green at the time. In my, you know, year and in between the two, basically, ended up getting a chance to fill in, and after Mike Conway's unfortunate accident at Indy at Dryden Reinbold, and then, you know, made my way into the series full time, kind of via a less direct route that way. I think you got to kind of, at this point, you know, the cars are all, teams are also, you know, very capable. You see what AJ Foyt Racing has done this year, really turning around, bringing some speed, and you get the right engineering group, and, you know, you get the right kind of group of people around you. You know, you can move up, and it can be sort of an unfamiliar environment. I think that, you know, the Steinbrenner situation, I think, is probably the most interesting part of this conversation, frankly, just because, you know, you've got to figure that they have the means to expand and grow. You know, the satellite teams have not typically been super successful as satellite teams.
Yeah.
So that's maybe not something that you would, I don't know, like, that's a tricky thing to kind of invest in, I think, but you know, that I think as the year goes on and we sort of see how Colton continues to do, you know, that's probably the most interesting thing to be looking at, I would say, right now. And for, you know, Pato, like, wherever he, you know, if he gets a shot, you kind of got to take it, right? I mean, you want to be able to move up, and you got to be aware of kind of being in the right type of situations and that kind of stuff. But there's a lot of talent, you know, even within the teams across the board these days. So I think given an opportunity, you know, chances are you should take it rather than kind of waiting for the exact right scenario to put itself together.
If again, with all these hypotheticals, if you were to win, if you got that money and you had other sponsors to go with, obviously sticking with Andretti would be a great thing. There's also a part of him that says that if all those things happen and Andretti is not an option, Coyne popped into my head as a perfect destination for him as a younger, well, I shouldn't say younger, but as a smaller challenger brand within the paddock. I think Pato being a great kid, but he is just fiery as heck. And I don't mean like as a bonehead, but just like this kid wants to just destroy. And I love that. So I just think him at Coyne would certainly bring a different, you know, different kind of competitive flavor. Sebastian, it is as hard-nosed as you come. Completely unrelenting, like, refuses for things to not be right. And will push no matter what you, whether you like it or not, whether it ruffles your feathers or not. He is 100% about success at all times. I also think having this, you know, really fired up young buck, like, come on, let's go, 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 it might bring some even more crazy dynamic there. So anyways, but I think that kid is in store for some pretty good things. But you could also say that about a lot, you know, Colton Herta as well, Santi Arusha, Aaron Tielitz. You know, the Indy Lights might not have a big car count this year, but obviously grid size has nothing to do with whether there's a bunch of talent stacked towards the front, and there certainly is. So that's a good thing. Let's move on to Josie Towers, at Girl in Black on the Twitters. Says, I would love to hear about your experience setting up the ECR cars, and if that will influence how you set up the number 66 this year. I assume that question's for you, not me.
Yeah, I think, you know, at ECR, we, you know, our stuff was had always been pretty fast, and we ended up sort of migrating towards a certain way of looking at the cars. You know, as you do in these things, if you're not putting on the pole, or you're not, you know, running in the top four at the end of the event, you know, year in and year out, you sort of question whether, you know, are there areas that we should be exploring here that are different, you know, whatever. I've certainly kind of had my view of that over the last couple of years, but, you know, certainly know the feeling of a car that's fast, and it kind of gotten used to it working a certain way and looking for certain things. You know, worked very closely with Ed and with Joseph before that. You know, we all worked together pretty well looking for the same stuff. So anyway, it'll be interesting getting in. Yeah, obviously I've seen the setups, and there are some differences for sure, but things that I'm optimistic maybe solve for some of the deficiencies that maybe we couldn't quite solve for or address them in different ways. So at Dreyer, so I'm just interested to get into it. You know, definitely knowing how good their car has been in race trim over the last few years, not coming in with the expectation that it needs to change much. You know, just looking forward to kind of getting to work and seeing what we've got once we get on track.
Got one more question we're going to hit on Twitter. And this one, you know, look, we're always willing to be real with folks, right? Steve Wade.
Of course.
Going into next week, are there any teams that you would foresee as being in danger of being bumped? The one-offs are being run out of teams that have shown speed at some point during the season, or in DRR's case, they know how to be successful at IMS. I mean, Steve, I don't know if I would couple teams failing to qualify so much as individual entries, because I don't think we're going to see an entire team. Well, let me rephrase that. Of the multi-car teams, I don't think we're going to see an entire multi-car team fail to make the show, but for some of the single entries, it certainly would be possible. Other quick proviso to throw in is, until we get the Pietro Fittipaldi situation sorted, we don't know if it's going to be one car to be bumped or two to be bumped. You know, how's this? From my end, I know that I have heard and received a lot of questions, if not straight-up comments, from IndyCar fans saying, I'm concerned about Carlin. I'm concerned whether they are going to have the ultimate speed come qualifying to stay in the show. I know Junco's Racing, for example, one car team with a rookie in Kyle Kaiser, is a team that might stand out as one to be concerned about, looking at the overall experience and talent spread across most of the field, JR. I'd also say that, you know, one thing Kyle has shown is he's pretty darn good on ovals, and he also has a veteran engineer in Tom Brown, who we could say his specialty engineering-wise is ovals. So that might be one that actually surprises instead of falls into the trap of, you know, a young driver, et cetera, et cetera, one-car team. Could they be on the bubble? Are there any others that stand out? I mean, I've had some folks say, oh, Pippa Mann might be in trouble, but then I look at the quality of the Dale Coyne cars in general.
And yeah, they were pretty darn good.
I think that that's, I don't want to make any boasts here, but they would appear to be bump-proof as an organization. But are there any without, you know, we're not picking on anybody, but ones where you go, ooh, they might have to work harder to stay in this year, since, you know, at least one or two folks are going to go home?
Yeah, I mean, I guess my breakdown of it would be, first, it sort of remains to be seen whether Honda or Chevy has the edge. So that will you know, that typically plays a role, at least, in kind of how all this plays out. You know, one manufacturer or the other in at the 1.4 boost level, 1.4 bar boost level, qual boost, will probably just be a little bit better, which either kind of helps its teams, its, you know, less competitive teams, you know, less high performing in qualifying trim teams, you know, raise their game a little bit to try to, you know, pull themselves out of that bubble zone, you know, or it'll happen the other way around. So that, I think, will probably have some impact on what's going on. You know, from there, I think, you know, we talked about this earlier, a lot of it does come down to just, like, can you get the cars to handle well over four laps? Preparation plays a huge role in being fast at Indy. Like, if the car rolls off the truck and it just goes down the straightaway fast, like, that helps a lot. And that's something that, you know, teams will pay a high, you know, a tremendous amount of attention to. You know, I think, frankly, that's sort of just on the prep part of it, that maybe hurts, you know, teams that are racing full-time as new teams a little bit. You know, just you don't have quite as much time. You don't have the bandwidth to be doing all of that prep ahead of time. So to your point, you know, I'm making no guesses in terms of who's going to be, you know, in trouble, like, on the outside looking in. But I think, you know, thinking that Carlin and Junkos are in that consideration, I would say based on nothing other than just the fact that they're new full-time teams, they're having to figure all of this stuff out all at once, that doesn't tend to lend itself to being super well prepared when you show up at Indy. You know, and kind of depending on how those two things shake out, manufacturer competitiveness and whether or not that, you know, just the question of bandwidth in prep plays a role, you know, just kind of comes down to, like, every once in a while, every year there's, you know, a couple of teams that really just start to struggle to put it together, you know, to be able to have the grip and the balance to be able to trim enough. You start thinking that you got to trim more because you just don't have the speed in the car. Yeah. And that's like a nasty spiral that you don't want to get into, you know? So, any one of those things could kind of play a role. You know, weird things happen depending on conditions and all that kind of stuff. I mean, you know, but I guess I would say those are the things that I would look for if I'm, you know, trying to kind of map out where it's going to end up.
All right, we've gone into overtime a little bit here. I'm going to jump over, and we're going to pick a couple of final questions here on Facebook, the ones that have received the most amount of likes. And I love that system, Jer. It's fairly democratic of, like, hey,
yeah,
y'all post questions. Tell me which ones you like the most, and we'll try to make sure we at least get those if we do have a little bit of limited time. You and the excuses, man. Oh, I've got to go to Indianapolis and be a race car driver. Whatever. All right. This one from Michael Wallace. It didn't get the most likes, but I like it, so I guess I got a little extra voting power here. Hey, Marshall and JR. Question for you, JR. As a driver in the paddock, is everyone mainly friendly there? And also, what happens if one driver genuinely doesn't feel safe with another driver on track?
That's a hard-hitting question.
Hey.
I would say, generally speaking, the drivers are all, you know, pretty friendly with each other. You know, you sort of, everybody's a part of, like, the same community, and, you know, you're going through the same stuff, the same kind of grind of the middle of the season and test days and, you know, whatever. Everybody has their periods where it's not going well. Everybody has some successes through the year. So, you know, I would say for the most part, you kind of, you're able to work together and sort of be on good terms with guys over the duration of the season. I would say that it happens pretty rarely that you're really, that anybody in particular is really concerned about the safety of driving around other guys. I will say for sure that that has happened, though. It tends to be the, you know, kind of like one-off guys when they particularly indie, you're just dealing with a higher number of dudes and guys that maybe haven't ever raced full-time IndyCar seasons or
nothing to lose. I'm going to the front.
Whatever. Yeah. That's definitely frustrating. Those guys usually just hear it straight up. So, there's not like a... That doesn't... that's not something that's dealt with diplomatically in most cases. And usually that's like pretty effective. So,
have you ever been in a driver's meeting where it popped off or, you know, one driver just decided to take, rip another instead of doing it face to face? Because, I've heard of such things, but I don't know if you've sat in one where like two guys were just, throwing down.
I don't know. Usually in the driver's meetings, it's a little bit more like passive aggressive. That guy that drives the blue and white car, or something. I don't know. It's not been like that in kind of recent years. I don't feel like too much. Some guys, you definitely see it pop up on social media and stuff like that every now and again, but I guess I would say among the actual drivers, there's not like a in person at the track, either in driver's meetings or, whatever, when you're walking out to practice or what have you. There's rarely kind of altercations from that perspective that are at least preemptive. Occasionally after races, you'll have guys that are pissed off at each other, but that doesn't, in my experience at least, that hasn't tended to last very long.
I love it. Let's see. David Zitterbart. JR, how do you keep in the racing mindset after going so long without racing in IndyCar? I guess we're talking 500, and just switch on at 227 miles an hour. He says, obviously the IndyGP helps and milk is motivation. He says, do you do a lot of sim work, shifter carts? What do you do to get your brain up to speed?
Yeah, I've done this kind of on and off for a couple of years running Indy. I think Indy is kind of unique just in that you do have time to get familiar. You don't have to be like flat track. It's not like your first time on track. You've got an hour long practice session, then you're going to qualify 2 hours after that. So from that perspective, it makes it a little bit less stressful, which, as we all know in our own life experiences, sometimes just makes it easier to do anyway. In this particular situation, like, I raced on the last super speedway that anybody else raced on, so like that's not a huge kind of break in the big scheme of things. I would say outside of just kind of being familiar with the steering wheel, and steering wheels are new this year, you guys have talked about that a bunch, some of the little things like that, little changes, there's not a lot that I'm, if I had run Long Beach or something, that's not actually getting me way more prepped to run an Indy in terms of the feel of the car or any of that kind of stuff than not doing it. So there, to the question about how do you kind of prepare otherwise, it's really difficult. Even getting on, I can run like the simulator on iRacing or project cars or, whatever on my own. Booking time in either HPD's or Pratt Miller simulator as part-time teams is really difficult, frankly. I this year fell into like the weird category of I couldn't do the open test day and I wasn't going to get a refresher and I couldn't do the manufacturer test day either. So that somehow worked out really badly. But at the end of the day, I've gotten used to having to just jump in the car, whether it's been at Indy or elsewhere. I think as race car drivers these days, that becomes a part of your skill set, is how prepared can you show up without being like physically prepped in terms of driving the car recently? How mentally prepared can you be to just get in and go? And for me, it's actually something that I kind of enjoy. Like, I enjoy having to get out there and just go. Like, the car doesn't feel right until you're flat out, car feels like garbage if you're part throttle running around at 210. So kind of a like weird, like almost sort of liberating feeling when you first get in the car and you just like pin it and you're up to speed and your mind kind of has to go through a shift and also get up to speed, and you know, then you're in it and you're rocking and rolling. So that doesn't maybe directly answer the question in terms of what else am I doing otherwise. Like, we're doing a lot of physical training. You know, I do things as a part of my physical training that, you know, keep me sharp mentally. You know, but at the end of the day, like, you have to be, I think a part of being a pro these days is being capable of just jumping in and sorting it out in a hurry without being, like, adequately up to speed.
Breaking news, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure 3 is going to be made, JR. And I know that'll make the two of us quite happy. Wild Stallions, hopefully there'll be a new soundtrack coming out here. We got a question from Facebook user, who would appear to have created a profile, asked a question, and then happened to dive out. And I love the questions. So, what if IndyCar took away some of the in-car driver tools like the weight jacker? This would obviously make the cars more difficult to drive over a full stint, but would it improve the racing with more of a premium put into car setup? I mean, let's just stick to the weight jacker in 500.
Yeah.
I mean, I know that for an Indy Lights race there, the setup that I came up with for my driver was so far off that he genuinely could not twist the weight jacker knob any further. He bottomed that sucker out. And thankfully, because we had the weight jacker and he was able to unscrew my screwed up setup, we were able to finish ninth. So, yes, boys and girls, Marshall Pruitt has a top 10 finish at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway in Indy Lights. I won't tell you that there were only 8 cars entered, but regardless, I know how much, you know, at worst case scenarios, boy, it can be a lifesaver if the setup is off. But even if it's really close, though, whether it is ambient changes throughout a 3-hour-plus race, tire pressures, you know, being adjusted and whatnot, what do you think life would be like without a weight jacker? And do you think it would spice up the racing? What would it do?
I don't. I mean, I think that, you know, it's maybe... you know, I've had the weight jacker or the, you know, roll bars, you know, front, rear, both, one or the other, whatever. I've had them kind of save my ass, kind of to your, you know, point. Like, there are times when the car starts to get really bad that one of those things being able to, like, go several clicks to the right or something, you know, with the weight jacker can be the thing that helps you get to an end of a stint. But they're not the, like, performance tuning tools that I think that I would lump a lot of other aids into. Like, they are things that help you as a driver get the most out of your setup for your style, I would say. You know, they're not things that, like, you know, just more generally add performance or make the car easier to drive. They really are tuning devices, not really, like, performance aids. You know, I would lump, like, traction control or, you know, ABS, power steering, you know, I don't know, things that are more like that. Even, you know, even to some degree, the engine mapping that we have access to now is very limited as compared to other series on purpose, because of the way the ECU works, we can only get a certain number of kind of different engine maps, and, you know, we can't get it to where it's like traction control or stability control or any of that type of stuff. We can just kind of, you know, make the power delivery more or less aggressive, basically. But you know, those are things, traction control, ABS, things like that, are genuine performance aids. Like, they make the car easier to drive. They make the car easier to operate all the way at its limit, because you're not having to manage the limit as much. You know, you have these other tools that are stepping in and allowing for you to just run the thing flat out, and it kind of works out where the limit is, you know, on its own and deals with that. So I would say that the in-car kind of manual tuning devices are, for me, in a different category from that perspective. And as such, if you took those away, you would just see, like, a greater separation in, you know, you'd see like those handful of guys that, you know, whereas they're able to use the tools to keep their car kind of close to the window through the end of a stint when the tires are really going off and they need to turn a front wing out, you know, those guys just like fall off the face of the map because they, you know, can't stay in it. I think you'd see more of that than that, you know, that somehow it would help separate drivers in any meaningful way.
All right, we're rounding turn four here, my man. A couple more to go, and then we are at the finish line. J.D. Ellis, this might end up, this is going to be a strong candidate for question of the week. Top three vintage cars you'd like to hop in and drive in anger, JR?
Oh, man, that is a great question. Okay, Porsche 917 30. Gotta do it, right? Shoot, that's a great question. Well, I don't know. I'm tempted to be like 917-30, you know, Eagle Mark III, and like, you know, Audi S1 Quattro Group B Rally Car or something. Those are like late 80s, early 90s. I don't know if those qualify as super vintage. I think like, you know, I have never actually driven any of the pre-wing, or, you know, I've driven a bunch of the, you know, sort of flat bottom winged F1 cars, like mid to late 70s F1 cars. I've never driven any of the kind of late 60s F1, any of the open wheel cars, whether they be like turbo offies or any of that stuff. I think that would like just be an interesting education in what those cars are like, but man, yeah, you gotta go for Can-Am GTP.
I love it.
Group B. I'd love to drive one of those Audi, whatever, the Audi 90
Audi
Trans Am
90,
cars.
Yeah, the Audi 200 Trans Am, Audi
200,
90
yeah,
GTO. You're singing the right tune here. Vincent Anderson says, what was it like to test a Formula One car with Paul DiResta? And I'll also ask about Paul DiResta as well.
Okay. It was amazing to drive the car. I mean, I was right out of Indy Lights the end of that year. The young driver test. So I did, Paul and I split 3 days. We each got half a day over 3 days at Jerez in Spain. I think that was actually Daniel Ricciardo's first time in the F1 car, maybe, at that same test. I'm not 100% sure. Rossi was there in the BMW. So pretty, you know, pretty good, like, crop of dudes. I came into it. We got selected among a group of drivers based on our sim time. So at that time, Force India had a technical relationship with McLaren Mercedes. They used the McLaren simulator. Force India, you know, sort of cycled several guys. Neil Yanni was there, Karun Chandak, maybe some other. I don't remember knowing who the other guys were, but there was, you know, a handful of guys. Myself and DiResta were among them. I think basically they chose the two of us because we were sort of the quickest in the simulator at Jerez, to be the two guys that did the young driver test. You know, particularly at that time, I had driven an Indy car like once for a day at Sebring, but that was it.
Wow.
You know, went out there, just the sheer ability of the car. I mean, in 2009, heading into 2010, that was kind of like the year prior to them reformulating the rules to slow the cars back down, so they were really high aero grip cars at that point. Still very lightweight, no curves or any of that kind of stuff, so super nimble, change directions really quickly, you know, high peak load capability, you know, at that particular kind of moment in time of the regulations. You know, I basically went into the thing knowing that I had never driven the car, I didn't know the track, I had not driven a GP2 car, done any of the European formula stuff. So I was basically, my aim was just to leave knowing that I had experienced what the thing was like at its limit, basically. And that, if I was able to parlay that into, you know, really understanding the car and putting the whole thing together and ripping great laps and being super impressive on the whole, awesome. But for me, it was really just about, you know, knowing that I had reached its max capacity, cornering, braking, like doing those kinds of things. And long and short of it is, over the duration of the test, I was certainly able to do that. I think I was in the high speed sections of the track. You know, those were where, that was where I was applying my most of my focus at the time, and you know, was super competitive in all of those areas. But as we all know, like, that's not where you make up all of your lap time. And it really, it took me a while. It took me more time and kind of more effort than I was expecting, just to wrap my head around the difference in the car's behavior because of how different the tires were.
Yeah.
It really ended up coming down to, like, kind of being able to manipulate the car, corner entry, mid-corner, in more technical parts of the track. And while I was kind of able to do that here and there, I was not, you know, I didn't fully grasp, like, how to do it consistently. And it was kind of, you know, the car, they're on 13-inch rims, so it's a much bigger sidewall. Sidewall is kind of a lot of the suspension of the car, basically. The car is super, you know, roll-wise is super stiff. You know, the car, the tire deflects a lot, and so it was very strange. You know, getting out of the Indy car, you have kind of a more direct feel for understeer, oversteer. You know, it's like going from a radial tire to a bias ply or something. So, Paul was great in those sections. Obviously, he ended up getting the gig for the third driver that next year, and then went on to be full time at the team basically until, I think, kind of just like some financial situations, you know, moved him out and he went to go do DTM. You know, an awesome experience, great to work with the team. The engineer that I worked with there is Verstappen's engineer now, Jean-Paul. He's awesome. No surprise, even just in a couple of days being there, that, you know, he's moved his way up the ladder. And, you know, cool experience that I'll always remember for sure.
I remember speaking to you right after you got back from that test, and you're like, "Whoa, that was amazing. That was also a lot." You know, this was.
Well, I mean, even coming out of Indy Lights, like, there's one button on the steering wheel in an Indy Lights car. You know, you've got, like, this goofy lever manual weight jacker, like, you know, the roll bar, the Indy roll bars, like, get stuck and you can't move them for the rest of the race. You know, so you forget about them. Getting into that thing, it's like, you know, just getting the car out of the pit lane, getting the car back into the pit lane is like, you know, twisting knobs and you got to get it in the right thing and, you know,
push
blah, blah,
this,
blah,
turn
blah.
That.
Like, it's all over the place. So, you know, that even for sure, like, looking back on it, I would have spent more time trying to devise a way of being more prepared, frankly, just for that, you know, like, spending more time at the shop, like, with the steering wheel, having somebody, you know, I think they're used to guys coming out of GP2 or coming over from DTM or whatever, and they're sort of used to managing a bunch of that kind of stuff. It was super fresh for me. I mean, that Indy Lights car in particular was, like, very analog. So, you know, just kind of a crazy experience being over there a lot, you know, like, trying to drink through a fire hose, but, you know, the cars were awesome, and it was a lot of fun.
The one button on your Indy Lights steering wheel was actually a horn.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right. We're going to round up here with three great questions. One from Jordan Darwin to start. JR, did you ever talk to Charlie Kimball about that last turn of the 2011 500? Should we tell folks that you guys actually meet up once a year in a cabin to reflect on that incident?
Cage fight.
Yes.
I don't know that we've ever really sat down and talked about it.
Unresolved, you know, issues. Ooh, someone's avoiding. Someone's deflecting.
We're both rookies. You know, like, the thing that like caught me off guard at one point, we were both in a room. He was being interviewed about it, and I ended up finding out that, like, my assumption was that he was actually running out of gas at the time. Like, that was what I had kind of been told afterwards was the reason for why he was, you know, going that slow. Ended up finding out that, like, his team had been telling him to slow down to try to go a lap down because they weren't going to make it around for another lap or something. So they needed to go a lap. They thought they needed to go a lap down to, like, I don't know, finish wherever they were at or something, which
wouldn't have to do another lap, which would certainly help from a fuel standpoint.
Well, but like if he's the last car to cross the finish line that's on a lead lap, then he can run out of gas that lap, and it's the same as being a lap down. So
yeah,
like that actually just doesn't make any sense. And he wouldn't, you know, like he wouldn't have known that in the car. So I don't fault Charlie for like any of it. He's kind of just being, yeah, as a rookie. I mean, I remember I was there as a rookie too. Like there was some information that I wish that I had gotten that was different, or, you know, had been able to be a little bit more aware of what I needed to be looking out for, or, you know, whatever at that time. You know, I'm sure if I put myself in his shoes, you know, I mean, you're just being told kind of what you need to try to do, and it's the last lap and everything's crazy and whatever. So, I'm over it, but, yeah, it's funny. It's kind of been something that hangs around a little bit. And, you know, we've gone through plenty of other kind of like races, and we've intersected plenty of other times elsewhere. So no stress on my end, and hopefully, you know, something that, you know, we can right the ship. That's what we do, go show up at Indy every year since then for.
I love that. We got a positive spin to close there. All right, two to go. Daniel Kincaid actually had the most likes of all the questions that came in here.
Okay,
and it's technical. So, well, kind of technical. Daniel asks, how fast do you need to go at Indy before you are able to feel a setup change? Could you feel a difference of ride height change at an average lap speed of 215 or so? Or need to push it somewhat to get a feel for a setup change? And then a second question is, any guesses for trap speeds and qualifying boost? 245 mile an hour plus maybe? So question of setup change, if we're using ride height as the example, JR, would a lap at 95% be enough, or do you need to be 100% to give the team true feedback on what it did?
You gotta be with it. I mean, the cars are so dependent on, you know, like if you're part throttle, pretty much, if you're out there out on the track in race trim in during practice on your own, you gotta be flat out to know what the car is doing, basically. Unless you can't be, basically. Like unless either the aero package that you're on and or the tire deg that you're at doesn't allow for you to do that. But I would say, frankly, if that's the case, given the way the cars are right now, like they're momentum machines at Indy, you know, you've got to be able to run the thing kind of in normalized, flat-out conditions to be able to know what the car is doing. Basing your judgments even just off of, like, a high tire deg run, you know, often you kind of get diminished returns on, even if you're able to be flat out, you know, the car starts to do things that you don't like. If you're doing like five lap runs, you know, and that's what you're going off of, you know, that can even be really tough. So the direct answer is I don't think you can ever really go off of like a 90% lap to make really good judgments. And a lot of that is just because the sensitivities at Indy are super high, you know, so you have to know that you're heading in the right direction, that you're making a good change. What was the second part of the question?
Any guesses for trap speeds?
Trap speed.
Qualifying boost.
I'm going to say, you know, maybe kind of like running up to the mid 230s, maybe. You know, last year to run 232, 231, 232, you're kind of, depending on, you know, and like you get a little bit, you get like a difference in wind, you get a tailwind down the back straight, maybe this is different. But yeah, I think we were sort of tickling like 240 and some change, just because the cars are more draggy this year. I just don't think you're going to see it be quite that high. So my guess would be kind of into the 230s.
Two guys from the San Francisco Bay Area Trust us, we know all about drag. All right, we are going to go out with a final question from Ryan Casillas. He says, two for John Randall. What are your racing plans outside of the month of May this year, if you can legally tell us? And second, what is it like having Sage Karam as a teammate, and have you ever seen him with his shirt on?
I have not yet seen him with his shirt off.
Wow, so he's been holding out on you.
But, you know, he's modeling and stuff. He is.
Great. He's a real genuine model.
Yeah, I know.
He's the only driver who actually has a bearskin rug next to his car to stand on before he steps into the cockpit. Now that is impressive.
It's just part of his vibe.
Maybe you should turn up shirtless.
So far, it's been good. I came out to Indy last week. He was allowed to do a refresher. So I just came out to observe, and I mentioned earlier in the pod, like, I think it would just be good to have he and Jeff Britton together, obviously, like, know what their car has been like in the past. So having that as the baseline for A to B from last year to this year, just for their car, so that I can then kind of, like, suss out, you know, what I'm looking for and maybe how it compares to my stuff and the fact, you know, my experience at ECR in the past and their setups and all that. I'm looking forward to it. And, I think in terms of the rest of my racing plans for the year, I've got some stuff that is actually, like, coming together that's going to be pretty cool. It's not, like, I'm kind of in the spot where, like, none of it's really finalized, but be bouncing around doing some different stuff, which was part of my aim. After the end of the year last year, I wanted to get a good deal together to run Indy, and obviously having Salesforce come on board and all that kind of stuff has been really awesome. But I was... after racing, you know, the full season IndyCar last year, I really didn't have any bandwidth to even look elsewhere. You know, I've always loved the idea of having more of a mixed bag in terms of what my schedule is for the year, racing different kinds of stuff. I haven't done that much sports car racing, and haven't gotten into, you know, stock car ever in a, like, meaningful way. So been chasing down some stuff like that, and see how it checked out, but looking forward to a fun rest of the season for sure.
Jerry Hildebrand, I owe you something, maybe espresso. You have gone way into overtime here to help us and share some fun tales and make us a wee bit smarter. So thank you for your generosity, brother.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, we are going to put this episode of the Week in IndyCar on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires, to bed. And I will look forward to seeing you here shortly once we start getting some Grand Prix of Indianapolis underway, and then the month of May after that. So I will see you here shortly in Indianapolis, my man, and I'm sure we will be sitting down and having more podcast fun before the month is done.